This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Because of this job, I don't get a chance to read as many novels as I'd like, and I end up reading a lot more news and nonfiction. But I am so glad to have read the novel we're going to be talking about today. It's enlightening and moving and entertaining, and it's also really important, especially in this pandemic year when many of us are looking back on past warnings about the potential for what we've gone through. And maybe we've also tuned out similar warnings about what's happening to our planet and can soon affect all of us. The Ministry for the Future is essential reading. Renowned science fiction writer and the author of several books, including The Ministry for the Future, is Kim Stanley Robinson. He's won several literary awards, including the Hugo Award for Best Novel, the Nebula Award for Best Novel, and the World Fantasy Award. His work has been labeled by The Atlantic as the gold standard of realistic and highly literary science fiction writing. Kim Stanley Robinson, thank you so much for being here on The 21st.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
For people who haven't read the book, can you briefly explain what is The Ministry for the Future?
Sure. The book is set in the starting about now and extending out about 30 years, and it describes the establishment of a committee of the Paris Agreement that all of the nations of the world tasked this committee with defending the rights of the generations to come and the citizens of the biosphere that can't speak for themselves, like animals and plants. So being a small UN committee, this is overwhelming and impossible, but they do their best.
And the ministry comes out of a heat wave, right? This is the event that launches the novel. Millions of people die. This is in India, but it could happen in a lot of places. And I was reading, you were born in Illinois, and I think you'd long since moved away by this time. But in 1995 in Chicago, we experienced a heat wave that led to hundreds of deaths. And for the 20th anniversary of this year, we talked to sociologist Eric Kleinenberg, who wrote a book about that event. And part of that heat wave in Chicago, and what you write about in your book in India, is this idea of wet bulb temperatures. And I fear this is a concept we're all going to have to get more familiar with. So can you talk about what is a wet bulb temperature? Why is that worrying?
Yeah, and in fact, that Illinois heat wave is famous because it represents one of the highest wet bulb temperatures ever recorded. It's simply a heat index, and everybody recognizes immediately that it's the combination of heat and humidity that can be deadly to humans. So we can tolerate dry heat because we sweat. We can't tolerate human heat because sweat doesn't work. We get parboiled. And that happened in Illinois in 95. Well, as the global average temperature rises slowly but surely, these wet bulb temperatures that reach fatal heights are going to become more and more common. And it's great that you mentioned the Chicago example, because what that shows is it isn't just the tropics. The tropics are in the worst danger, and they have huge populations. And these power grids in the tropics are not as strong as they are in the United States. And right when you need the power most, you are likely to lose it. And at that point, very fatal events are all too possible. I mean, I really wrote this book out of the fear that we are on the brink of some devastating heat wave, mass death.
Yeah, and this could come anytime, anywhere, really. Go ahead.
I think you're okay. You're okay if you're in the Yukon. It's not
well. Fair enough.
There's about a third of the Earth's surface, and it does extend up into Midwest and various continental places. It could even happen in parts of Siberia. So I think maybe you're right. The weird thing about climate change is that we're getting really abnormal temperatures at the poles, like sometimes 40 degrees warmer than it's ever been recorded before near the North and South Pole. So, yeah, let's just say anywhere.
Sure. So one of the devices you use in the book are eyewitness accounts. And I was reminded of Studs Terkel or maybe Murakami's book on the sarin gas attack on the Tokyo subway. And just to give listeners a flavor of this, I mean, it ranges from the time the ultra wealthy gathering at Davos was hijacked into a sort of re-education camp to a town that people remember the day the water ran out in that town. Can you talk about how you came to include, to decide on this as a literary device in this book, these eyewitness accounts?
Yeah, and thank you for that, because it was a great pleasure for me. I wanted to write a novel, and yet I wanted to talk about 30 years of things happening all over the earth. And that was at the normal speed of the scenes in novels, the dramatized scenes. That was implying, you know, 30 or 40,000 pages worth of stuff. But eyewitness accounts are incredibly compressed, and they have a propulsive power to them because people are remembering years later something that was important. And so the rule in writing workshops that you show, don't tell, that gets reversed in eyewitness accounts. You tell. You don't waste time with setting the scene. You get to the point. And Studs Terkel is great on this. His book Working was inspirational to me, and I read about maybe a dozen collections of eyewitness accounts of various famous events. And I realized that that was the mode that I needed, and I could write fictional eyewitness accounts from all around the world. At moments, someone told me this, it wasn't my idea, but they read the book and said, it's when the slow violence of the system that we live in turns into fast violence, where suddenly a crunch time comes. And that's where I tried to have my eyewitnesses and tell their stories.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that idea of slow violence and some of the interesting ways that it's explored and contrasted with that fast violence. But it struck me that these are also moments when abstract ideas become concrete for people in a very sudden way, in an afternoon sometimes. You know, September 10th, was it 2034? You turn on the water flows. September 11th, you turn on the tap, nothing happens. The idea of climate change in particular in this story goes from something on the news to something where my kids are thirsty. There's no water. And we live with these warnings. Even those of us here in Illinois, you know, we're not on a coast. It's a relatively temperate area. But last year, Moody's Investor Service and the climate research group 427 issued a report. This is in the context of local governments being able to repay their debt. And the report said that the highest levels of heat stress will be concentrated in Missouri and western Illinois. And for the Midwest, which is a major agricultural producer, these changes have the potential to alter labor productivity and crop yields. I wonder why you think these types of warnings fail to resonate.
Well, I think it's partly part of our cognitive history as human beings. Evolutionarily, it's a useful thing to keep trying even when you're in terrible trouble, and basically not believe that you're in terrible trouble, so that you can keep going forward. So it's now become a kind of famous cognitive error, and it's very near Illinois. Michael Lewis talked to a town that was 10 miles from a town that had been completely trashed by a tornado coming through and ripped the other town apart. And the people in the town 10 miles away said, well, that happened to them. It can't happen to us because they're in a tornado track and we're not. And so I think we don't believe it until it is actually happening to us. And it takes a different part of the evolution, the planning part, the part that looks at consequences of actions, to overwhelm the disbelief that we have that the bad thing can ever happen to us. So it's a contest inside every mind, and it's a contest inside every society. As to which part of the human warning systems that you pay attention to. And I must say, I think momentum is growing for really paying attention to climate change. In Illinois, you have vast belts of corn that are being used for ethanol. And now the way they grow the corn, they're trying to store some carbon in the ground every season that they grow it. So that's carbon drawdown. And then the corn that gets burned as ethanol, well, that gets goes into the atmosphere as CO2, but it also was not released from fossil carbon. It gets drawn back down the next time that corn grows, and so you've got a closed cycle. So everywhere, I mean, ethanol is just one very small part of the puzzle, but everywhere what you see is people beginning to try to decarbonize, and that's the crux of the climate change battle. We have to decarbonize faster than ordinary technological change would have it happen. And so that requires changes in economics and in changes in emphasis in how we live and changes in the whole political economy is going to have to rally as if in some giant war, which is in this case a war for survival, to commandeer the entire economy in some ways to stimulate really rapid decarbonization. And the Paris Agreement is the international framework for that to happen. And people, I mean, the Paris Agreement is kind of a miracle. 2015, if I had written it in a science fiction story in the year 2004 when I started writing climate fiction, everybody would have laughed. It would have been a utopian gesture. But actually, it's a real thing. So I think...
Yeah, well, I want to ask about the Paris Agreement. Why do you think that is? Because I think a lot of people sort of dismiss it as weak tea. And, you know, certainly that we've had 4 years of a president who has made it sound like the worst thing in the world. Why, and it is very important to your story that you tell in your book. Why do you think the Paris Climate Agreement was so important?
Well, every country on Earth signed on to it, and they agreed to decarbonize. Now, it is weak tea in the sense that it's a voluntary agreement, and countries set their own targets. And a lot of countries aren't even meeting them, but other countries are. And the thing is, what else have we got? We have a nation-state system in a single biosphere, and so each nation is going to be looking out for its own interests. Its government is, and its people are going to be thinking nationally. On the other hand, we've got a planetary problem that we're all hooked in together. So the Paris Agreement is all we've got, and it's a major event in world history. When they write the history of the world, if we get to write one, you know, 500 years from now, the Paris Agreement will get a giant page. And now I have to say, it could turn into the League of Nations. But if it turns into the League of Nations, in other words, a good idea that failed, then we aren't going to be writing histories in 500 years. We're going to be scrabbling around on a jungle planet trying to survive. So I would say the Paris Agreement is very important. It needs to be improved, but they meet every year, and every 5 years they have a global stock take where they see how they're doing. And it's simply the mechanism. So it's like the UN, but for something that we can't avoid.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson, who is a renowned science fiction writer. His latest book is The Ministry for the Future. We want to invite you to join our conversation. I'm sure we have some Kim Stanley Robinson fans out there. So if you have a question of him or a question about his new book, our lines are open. The number to call is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st show. That's at 21st show. We need to take a break here, but I just want to tease a couple of the things we're going to be talking about after the break. I'm particularly interested in our personal culpability in the climate crisis. This is something that, you know, I think we struggle with. Is this something we frame as we need to recycle more, we need to put solar panels on our house, or is this something that can really only be solved through collective action? The book, The Ministry for the Future, has some interesting things to say about that, and we're going to be talking about it after a short break. More with Kim Stanley Robinson here on The 21st. Listeners, you can call in 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Kim Stanley Robinson, the renowned science fiction writer. He's the author of many books. They've won many awards, the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, World Fantasy Award. His latest book is The Ministry for the Future. Ezra Klein, the writer, formerly of Vox, soon to be of the New York Times, called it the most important book he's read this year. I think I probably agree with that sentiment. It has some bleak moments. It's about the near future. It imagines the near future in terms of the climate. It definitely has some bleak moments, but ultimately it is an optimistic story. If you want to join our conversation, the number to do so is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. Kim Stanley Robinson, I want to talk about our personal culpability in the climate crisis, right? I recycle, I turn off the lights when I leave the room, but the equipment I'm using to talk to you right now that I use every day to do this radio program. It's powered by burning coal in a plant a couple of miles from my house. The coal gets to that plant by an endless convoy of tractor trailers, bringing it from a mine a little ways up the interstate. What is our individual culpability in this crisis?
Well, it's 1/8 billionth of the responsibility. So, there is an individual component, but it's partly because we're in an all-hands-on-deck situation where everything that can be done has to be done as quickly as possible. And it's partly because we're Americans and we're burning about 30 times as much carbon as your ordinary citizen of India every year. And that's partly because we're rich and a little profligate with carbon burning, and it's partly because of the infrastructure that got built here that isn't our fault that we have to use. I mean, some of your audience will be living out where they have to drive to get to their groceries and get to work and do their jobs. Some will be in apartments in a city where they can walk or use public transport. I mean, everything's deranged by the pandemic, but you see what I'm saying. Everybody's got an individual carbon burn that can be easily calculated, and young people should be pretty pleased at what they see, because it's generally the case that when you're younger, you aren't burning as much carbon simply because of your economic situation. And it's a kind of stylishness for an individual American to realize that they're living a better life than they ever lived before, while burning less carbon as a kind of act of style. It's not suffering. It's more like being stylish and seeing that there's a smarter way to do things. But that's just the individual component of how we behave. And although important, it's way more important that we change the infrastructure fast. And that comes down to political representation. We have to elect politicians that will truly represent us and not the corporate interests that have funded them in part. And then when they're representing us, they'll stop underwriting and subsidizing fossil fuels. They'll start underwriting and subsidizing clean energy and the transfer and the full employment. The jobs that would result from making that transfer of technologies fast would mean a lot of public works projects that would be accomplished by private companies, but the impetus would have to come from governments. So it's an all hands on deck situation. And as an individual, you have to understand that your life as a citizen, as a voting citizen, and as someone who speaks at town council meetings and does all of the things that a citizen should do, is easily the equal of your individual lifestyle choices as a carbon burner.
Interesting thought there that recycling, great. Go speak at your city hall at the town meeting. Doing more possibly than all your individual choices. I want to go to the phones. Daniel is calling from Rochester, a town just outside Springfield. Daniel, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you so much.
Do you have a question for Kim Stanley Robinson?
Yes. Just a comment. I've still got the original Mars trilogy. I love his work. I love it because his science is so good. I wanted to ask him what he thinks about the current attitude towards science these days.
Okay, thank you for the call, Daniel. We appreciate it. Stan, what do you think? What do you think about the way science has kind of gotten a rough go in some quarters in America recently?
Yeah, well, thanks to Daniel for that question, because I want to say that everybody believes in science, no matter what they say in public about it, because it supports their lives. They're alive because of it. Their food comes from a scientific process. 8 billion people alive on this planet is a scientific accomplishment. And when these people who speak against science get sick, as a certain ex-president did, they run to a scientist, which is your doctor. Your doctor is a scientist, and the medical community that keeps you alive like 20 to 30 years longer than you would have been otherwise is all a group of scientists doing science for the betterment of humanity, which is usually what science is up to. So I'm a big believer in it, and I believe in the scientific method, and also the nested groups of institutions that makes up the scientific community that uses the scientific method and peer review to make their choices and their pronouncements. That's the best we've got. That's the gold standard in evidence-based reasoning and talking about how to deal with 8 billion people in a biosphere that in a kind of state of nature or without science would only support about 1 billion. So we're at the tip of a technological and scientific achievement that has to keep going for us to live the lives that we lead. And I think most people know that, so that the talk against science was just blather.
A few moments ago, you mentioned the idea of all hands on deck, and we have to be doing everything we can. And one of the interesting ideas in the book, the head of the Ministry for the Future, this, if people are just tuning in, this international organization set up through the Paris Climate Accords to sort of represent the future people and animals and the biosphere generally, people who don't really have a voice in today's discussions. This head of this ministry is talking to a colleague and learns that her agency might have a so-called black wing. This is sort of like a covert operations group. I want to read from the book here. Quote, possibly some coal plants have experienced problems. They've had to go offline. And the investment crowd has seen that and understood that they won't ever be good investments again. In a sense, you could say that worked, end quote. This kind of thing would, of course, be denounced possibly as violence. I mean, there's one group in the book that is carrying out assassinations, it seems. But your book raises this idea, and we talked about this earlier, about this other form of violence running the other way from the people ensuring we burn as much carbon as we can, slow violence. Can you talk about that and this idea about how far people should be going to protect the biosphere?
Yes, although I must say this is a really tough topic. I mean, I am a middle-class suburban white male American, and what I believe in is the rule of law, that we should change the laws and act in a nonviolent way. Civil disobedience, sure. Sabotage is interesting because that would be property, not people. I am absolutely opposed to violence against persons in any way, shape, or form. But there is the slow violence of the 2 billion people who have not clean water or sanitary facilities in this world. That would be the total population of Earth in 1960, and now that number of people are immiserated, and that's the system we live in. So what I want to say is that there are black ops in this world, and these kinds of cyber attacks are happening now. And if we get into what you might call a war for the Earth, if the fossil fuel interests dig in and try to burn the 3,000 gigatons of carbon, fossil carbon that we've identified in the ground that would torch the climate, then there's going to be a kind of a war for the Earth. And these kind of things are going to happen. And that's not going to be good for anybody if they do, but I feel that they are inevitable if we don't do it by legal means first. So I would argue for the legal means. Please, let's get the legislation. Let's elect the politicians. Let's change the laws. Let's change the tax structures so that burning carbon gets intensely and progressively taxed. And maybe that can be a pass-through where the money comes back to citizens, like in Alaska. Sure, fine. But the carbon needs to be as expensive as it really is. And that would be a huge change at the political level that would help to avoid some of these violent resistance actions that are sure to come if we don't do that.
Yeah, and we know so much of this technology exists already the U.S. government interfered with Iran's nuclear production capability with a computer virus. One can imagine that, you know, if that is ever weaponized in the climate fight, you know, trying to interfere with oil pipelines or things like that. These are some of the ideas that are explored. It's interesting. We have about 5 minutes remaining in our conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the pandemic that we've been through this year. And in some ways, it strikes me that this is maybe a dress rehearsal for what we're going through with climate change. And I wonder if it leaves you feeling optimistic or worried about the years ahead, right? I mean, personally, I'll put my cards on the table. I'm not feeling a lot of confidence, given that much of what our political leaders had to do this year, which a simple thing would have been directing and even asking people to wear masks. There were a lot of people who didn't even want to do that. And that's a lot easier than the tough choices we're going to have to make in terms of responding to the climate crisis. So what about you? Are you optimistic or worried based on what you've seen this year?
Well, we've seen some good as well as bad. We've seen an incredibly rapid response from the scientific community in understanding this pandemic and in making vaccines. And this is way faster than it's ever happened before. It was an emergency response and it worked. And this is another great demonstration of science in action. And then there's been good countries. There's been countries where often with women leaders who have said, look, wear the mask, but also let's do the social distancing. Let's close down shop for a long enough time that we wipe out this pandemic, and they've managed to do it. So there's now a comparative examples nation by nation of how to deal and how not to deal. And if you deal with it right, you actually are walking around today in a country that doesn't have any deaths per day. And they're small countries, they're easier to organize, but on the other hand, it can be done. And the rapidity of the response and also the global awareness. Okay, we had a pandemic. That means a worldwide epidemic. We're on one planet, we're all connected with each other. Airplanes make it the case that we are all in contact with each other. The climate disasters coming down will be weirder than the pandemic, but they might also not require the closing down of the economy and of things like restaurants and movie theaters. They might be allowing sociability, which I think is the main hit. That we're a social species, and the pandemic said, look, stay by yourself for a year. Well, that's just very hard. If you're young, if you're old, if you're in between, we are a social species and want to congregate. And that's part of what's going on here. And, you know, one of the things about the climate crises coming down is some of them are going to require that you congregate in order to get into an air-conditioned building for a heat wave, or in order to go to where there's the only water source, or to get out of a storm. And so there'll be more congregation. And so the psychic pain of being isolated and not being able to be a social creature, that isn't going to be a constant feature. That's a feature of this pandemic. It's not a necessary feature of climate change. Climate change is not going to force you to become a hermit. You know, it's a mixed picture. And what I wanted to do is emphasize that we're not doomed. That although there is some enormous challenges coming down the pike that are difficult socially, as you pointed out, it is not the case that no matter what we do right now, we are doomed anyway. That is that's actually being promulgated again by the climate deniers and by the fossil fuel industry. First, they say, oh, there's no such thing as climate change, so you don't need to do anything. Then they say, oh, there is climate change, but it's too late, so you don't need to do anything. It's the same response. They're trying to tell people don't do anything because there's no point to it. Well, there is a point to it. It's hugely different what life will be like in the year 2060. And many of your listeners will be alive in 2060. The young people with luck will be alive and in their the age I am now. Well, they want to have a good life, and it matters hugely what we do in the next decade, whether they're enjoying a good life or whether they're struggling through a wounded civilization. So it matters, and a good outcome is possible physically, technologically, socially. So that's, you got to keep your eye on the prize there and say, look, since a good outcome is possible, we owe it to our descendants. And for young people, you owe it to your old age to throw yourself into the fight right now.
Throw yourself into the fight right now. It is definitely not too late. I think that's a nice place to end this conversation. Kim Stanley Robinson is the author of many award-winning science fiction books. You might know him for the Mars trilogy. His latest is The Ministry for the Future. It's an important book. It's a really enjoyable book to read, and I recommend it highly. Kim Stanley Robinson, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
And that is all the time we have for this week. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Our interns are Zainab Qureshi, Briel Skullark, and Chantel Vaca. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. Thank you to the band Public Access for our theme music. This is our final live show that we're planning before the end of the year. We're going to be rebroadcasting some of our favorite conversations in the next couple of weeks. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Happy holidays.